Greetings, everyone. I'm George Gordon. Gather round, let me tell you the story about the law. These discs now take the place of my general law tape. And there are about as many opinions about this thing called law as there are people to opine about it. If any one of those opinions were true, then all of the rest would have to be false, wouldn't they? Now, confusion abounds, and the blind lead the blind, and they all fall in the ditch. Now, I teach law here at the Gordon Law School. I teach pro se litigation to people just like you, Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. Housewives, doctors, dentists, truck drivers, plumbers, carpenters, electricians, businessmen all come to school here, and they all have one thing in common, and that is they're all subject to the law. And we're all involved in the law, whether we like it or not. And that's because we all have driver's licenses that bind us to thousands of traffic rules and regulations. Most people don't know how many traffic laws and regulations there are in their code, but they have a driver's license for which they have voluntarily agreed with the state that they will obey them all. We have business licenses that bind us to the Uniform Business and Professions Code. The average businessman or professional wouldn't have a clue as to where to find that code with both hands at high noon and a map. We have marriage licenses that subject us to the Department of Family Services, the Welfare Department, child support laws. But we don't understand those laws, we don't know what those laws are, and those laws are being added to by the legislature every session. But you don't know anything about them. And government prosecutes all of us for any violation of these laws. And the question arises, well then, how do we cope? How do we defend? Well, I've developed 8 schools to teach citizens, just local Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives, the average run-of-the-mill carpenter, plumber, electrician, the blue-collar workers, and the professionals. So whether you're a professional or a blue-collar worker, the law affects you just like it does me. And the question arises, how do we defend? The 8 schools are tax and status, courtroom strategy and procedure, my private business school, civil rights, subsistence and survival, how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less, family law, and the Mosaic Law School, the law that everyone believes is abolished, repealed, nullified, archaic, harsh, done away with, and nailed to the cross with Jesus. Well, let's start with the income tax. Well, it's not over till it's over on April the 15th. You know, if you stop, for example, to buy a pizza on a Thursday night to celebrate being done with the IRS for another year, the tax man will be right there to grab a slice or two of that pizza. On top of paying the sales tax, you will also be picking up a major chunk of what the government charges or taxes that pizza store owner for local property taxes, unemployment insurance taxes, federal payroll taxes, federal and state and local income taxes, and workers' compensation insurance. Altogether, according to a study by the Americans for Tax Reform, that comes to $3.80 on a $10 pizza. Think of that. 38% of the price of that pizza is tax. Now, if you pick up a Bud six-pack to go with the pizza, there's another 43 cents of each beer dollar that goes straight to the tax man to pay the excise tax, income tax, property taxes, and so on. For something a little stronger, let's say you want to drink some Jack Daniels or Wild Turkey, then the tax man share is $7.20 on average out of every $10 bill that you spend on booze. Now that's 72%. 72%. What does the government do to produce that bottle or that fifth of Jack Daniels for which the government ought to be paid 72 cents? Now go a little lighter and just drink, say, Pepsi Cola. That's 35% of what you pay for that Pepsi Cola goes to taxes at all levels. Now add some Marlboros and it's 75% on a pack of cigarettes. That's right, 75% of the retail price that's funneled directly into the state's coffers. Now get home and hit the light switch and another 26% or $26 out of every $100 bill that you spend on electricity goes to the government rather than for or to the production of electricity. Now, if you're up and flying the next day, the tax man is up early and waiting at the airport for you, and the government pockets $40 on every $100 bill that you spend on an airline ticket. And he's there in the hotel lobby when you land, snatching 43%. $43 of every $100 that you spend in the hotel goes to tax. When you go out to dinner, it's another 28%. That's $28 out of every $100 bill of the tab that ends up with the government rather than with the restaurant. You know, the restaurant, the farmers, the truckers, and everyone else who work together to produce the meal make less than $28 out of every $100 bill that you spend. The people who actually produce that meal don't get as much as the government does, and the government does absolutely nothing to prepare it. Now, at each and every stop, in items large and small, the greedy hand of government has its sticky fingers in every pocket with bread. A recent study by Price Waterhouse shows that there are 30 different taxes imposed on the production and sale of something as common as a loaf of bread. And it accounts for 27% of the average retail price. So more than a quarter of the price of the bread is in tax. Now buy some tires. That's 36%. $36 out of every 100 goes to the tax man on a set of tires. Now on the price of a new car, an Americans for Tax Reform study shows that the total tax reaches 45% of the showroom sticker price. 45% of the sticker price is taxed. Add some gas, and 54% of what you pay for a fill-up goes for 43 different federal, state, and local taxes rather than to the oil producer, the retailer, or anybody in between who actually drills the oil well, produces the oil, ships it, refines it, produces it, delivers it, and pumps it into your tank. Now, at the start of our nation's unique experiment with individual sovereignty and limited government, taxation without representation was called tyranny. That was the watchword of the American Revolution. For our founding fathers, a level of taxation of only a few cents on a dollar siphoned off to a faraway and arrogant bureaucracy in England was enough to ignite a revolution, enough to grab the trusty musket off the wall. Today, in contrast, if we dare to startle the more panicky among us by buying a good rabbit gun, the government's there at the cash register to check our papers and then seize $46 of every $100, 46% of the price of that gun goes to taxes. And all of this, of course, this immense pile of hidden taxation is stacked on top of our local property taxes and our local, state, and federal income taxes. Is there a way out? Well, not so easy. Let's suppose that you act up and phone the IRS bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. and you complain about our out-of-control government, and the tax man grabs another $1. That's 50% of every $2. That's a dollar out of every two. 50% of what you spend on your telephone bill goes to taxes. Then if you get discouraged and get drunk, it's another 43 or 72% out of every dollar that you spend that gets siphoned off to the state, depending on whether it's Coors or Wild Turkey. For the average family, all of these taxes now eat up 38% of your total gross income. 38% of your gross income. Now, that's a higher rate of taxation than ever before in the peacetime history of the United States. Now, if you'll think about it, 38% of your gross. You don't have a dime to spend until after you have paid 33% of your gross to income tax and Social Security, because the Social Security tax takes 15.3% to 16.1%. Right off the top, for which then the lowest tax bracket is 17%. That's 17% to 45%. Then you get to pay your property taxes and gasoline taxes and all the rest of the taxes, of which there are 14 taxes that you pay that consume approximately 75% of everything you create and produce. Well, we're now at the absurd point where the typical family works until noon of every working day to satisfy the tax man, paying more in taxes than you spend on food, clothing, and housing combined. So you know there's three things that you have to live. That's food, clothing, and shelter. You're now spending more on taxes than you do on the basic necessities of life. Now today, with 480 different tax forms, 17,000 pages of laws and regulations, and a federal tax code that's more than 7 million words, compared to only 773,000 words in the Bible. That's right, 773,000 words, and that's in both the Old and New Testament, compared to 7 million words just in your federal tax code. That doesn't include your state or your local tax codes. Nearly 60% of Americans are paying a professional to help them negotiate this tax maze. And every year, the IRS sends out 8 billion pages of forms and instructions, enough paper to stretch 28 times around the earth, to conform with this federal Rube Goldberg tax code. Americans are spending 5.4 billion hours and $200 billion a year just in compliance costs. Not counting the taxes paid, just the compliance cost is $200 billion a year. Now, to give you an illustration, how much money is $200 billion a year? Well, it's more time and money than it takes to produce every car, every truck, and every van every year in the United States. That's right. If you took the entire automobile industry, we spend more money on just income tax compliance than the entire auto industry. Isn't that just special? Now, when this federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied on only the super wealthy. It was the richest one-half of 1% of the population, with a top tax rate of about 7%. Today, of course, the fears of these early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. By the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was over 90%, and the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. In 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th before earning enough to satisfy the tax man at all levels. And this year, the average American family will work all the way through until May 12th in order to earn enough to pay their federal, state, and local tax bills. May 12th. That's called Tax Freedom Day. You ever heard that term, Tax Freedom Day? Back in 1932, in the Idaho Supreme Court, they made a pretty startling statement here. This comes from Diefendorf versus Galea. Let me tell you a little story here about the income tax from the Supreme Court of Idaho. And they kind of tell us a little piece of the story. Because in the tax protest movement, or the Patriot movement, you oftentimes hear the term or the statement made that the tax code does not tell us what the income tax is. Nowhere in the tax code is there a definition of income tax. Well, that's not true. The tax code does have the definition of the income tax contained in it, but most people who are not trained in law can't find it. So let me point it out to you. Here in the Idaho State Tax Code, the Supreme Court, in a case called Idaho, this is Diefendorf versus Galay, this is the Idaho Supreme Court, they said income is defined as, all right, now get your pen and paper out, sharpen your pencil on both ends, because here comes the definition for income. In case you've always wondered, what is it? Now I'm going to tell you. Income is defined as something. Write that down. S-O-M-E-T-H-I-N-G. You got it right straight out of the Supreme Court of Idaho. Income is something. And whatever this something is, it is derived from property. Got that? I knew you'd love it. Income is defined as something derived from property, labor, skill, ingenuity, or sound judgment, or from two or more in combination. Cited in Stony Brook Rail Corporation versus Boston and Maine Railroad Company. 260 Massachusetts, 379. So the Idaho Supreme Court cited it from the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Now, the income tax has been around for a long time. You see that in Schaefer versus Carter. Yeah, the very first income tax imposed in the United States was in New York State in 1778. Did you get that? Write it down. 1778, New York State, first income tax. That's just 2 years after the Declaration of Independence. Now, the same meaning, this court goes on to say, appears to have attached to the term property in all subsequent taxing legislation and in the taxing practices of the executives, and we take judicial notice. Judicial notice. That means you don't have to come in here and prove this. We take judicial notice. It's common knowledge in law that income as such has never been assessed or taxed as property in the state of Idaho. Common knowledge. Common practice. Courts take judicial notice that income has never been assessed or taxed as property. Income is not property. Now, here's an interesting concept. Did you know that property has never been assessed or taxed in the United States of America under our Constitution? Yeah, that's right. See, property is a right. Rights can't be taxed. Ah, so there's something about this income. Did you know that income is called an excise tax? Just two kinds of taxes, two types of taxes. Under our Constitution, we have two taxes. It's direct and indirect. Isn't that amazing? That's easy to learn, direct and indirect. It's almost like up and down, left and right, direct and indirect. Well, a direct tax is where we come to everybody and we say everybody pays $2. That's a direct tax. But an indirect tax is a tax where, like gasoline, we go in and buy a gallon of gasoline for $1.25, and there's 43 taxes on that, but you don't know what those taxes are. Those are called hidden taxes. Somebody else paid the tax, and then he just passed it on in the cost of goods sold. Now, on page 633 of Diefendorf versus Galay, listen to this. This is a real neat statement. It says, income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. The state furnishing the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it, and a tax thereon in the last analysis is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. Isn't that risk real special? Listen to this again. Sharpen your pencil. Listen up. Income is necessarily the product of the joint efforts of the state and the recipient of the income. Now, what is it when we have a joint effort? You know, if you and I were working together in a joint effort, what would we call that? It's called a partnership. So income is necessarily the product of the partnership of the state and the recipient of the income. You, Joe Sixpack, receive an income. And this income is not property. Because if it was property, Joe, we couldn't tax it. So whatever it is that you're doing to create and produce this income, it isn't property, and you have no property right in this income. Now, you know, in olden days, we didn't make income, we made increase, and we paid a tithe on our increase, which was property. Today, we pay a tax. We pay a tax on our income, which is not property. It's an excise privilege that we receive from government. Now, we have converted then our right to property to an excise privilege. Here's the next statement, or the next sentence. It says, the state furnishes the protection necessary to enable the recipient to produce, receive, and enjoy it. So the state, one of your two partners here in this limited general partnership, furnishes the protection necessary. Necessary protection. What kind of protection did you need, Joe? Oh, you needed unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, and 108 benefits under the Social Security program called the safety net. Remember, George Bush said, what Americans want are jobs, 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 and we have to have a safety net. Well, gee, Joe, you got to pay for the safety net, don't you? And so we pay an income tax, which is an excise tax, on a joint venture, a partnership between you and the state furnishes the protection, the insurance, the limited liability necessary to enable you, Joe, the recipient, to produce, receive, and enjoy this income. Isn't that just real special? The state makes it possible for you to produce, receive, and enjoy this income. Not property, income. A franchise. So the tax, this income tax thereon, in the last analysis, is simply a portion cut from the income and appropriated by the state as its share thereof. Hey, you know, you got a partner, and your partner, he produces something in this partnership to enable you to make this income. And so the state comes along and says, gee, Joe, shouldn't you pay me a portion? So if you're wondering why the state takes, in some cases, 72%, 43%, 45%, 38%, the state is just taking its share of a partnership agreement. Now, I know you're probably sitting there saying, well, why, I never made any agreement with the government. Well, you didn't make any agreement that you knew about, but you have an agreement. You have a partnership. You have a contract. In fact, you have a contract in writing. Yeah, that's right. It's in writing. A written contract. It's called Social Security. Social Security. Now listen to this. In labor and labor relations, cited from 48 American Jurisprudence, second edition, section 1, I'm on page 80. In labor laws, the term labor may be used in a comprehensive sense as including those who toil with their brains as well as those performing manual work. So whether you're working as an insurance salesman or agent, or whether you're digging ditches or driving a truck, in labor laws, the term labor may be used in a comprehensive sense as including those who toil with their brains as well as those performing manual work. So if you're working in a bank, that's called labor. Now, the constitutional protection of your right to work is in Section 2, and it says the right to labor and to its protection from unlawful interference is a constitutional as well as a common law right. Every man has a natural right to the fruits of his own industry. Isn't that kind of neat? So the right to labor and to its protection from unlawful interference is a constitutional as well as a common law right. The common law goes clear back to Moses at Mount Sinai. And a constitutional right goes back to 1787. And every man, and that includes you ladies too, and every woman has a natural right to the fruits of your own industry. What you create and produce is yours. You got a right to it. 100% of it. Isn't that kind of neat? Now, you go to work for General Motors and they pay you $10 an hour. You work for 40 hours and at the end of the week, they give you a check for $400, right? Well, dream on, because you're going to get a check for about $310. They're going to take $90 out and send it to your partner, and in some cases, partners, you know, like the labor union. They get a share called dues. And then, of course, the Social Security Administration, they're a partner, and so they get a cut, 16.1%. And then, of course, there's the government, the income tax, and they get a cut of it. And then there's a bunch of other taxes over here that you're paying for that you contracted for. That kind of neat? Now, labor is deemed to be property. Property's never been assessed or taxed in the United States. Labor is deemed to be property. Somebody said to me one time, well, they're taxing my labor. Oh, no. No, sir, government doesn't tax your labor. That's against the law. Now, picture this. You go to work at General Motors. You work there 40 hours. That's labor. At the end of the week, they give you $400, less 90. So you get net 310, and your partners take 90. And you say, they're taxing my labor. No, they're not. They're taxing the dollars. They're taxing the unjust weights and balances that are prohibited in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36, and Deuteronomy 25. Oh, I guess it's about 13 through 16. All right, so let's picture this and understand it. You see, God comes along and he says, I want you to practice strict liability. And we came along and said, God, you dum-dum, you don't understand international high finance. We need to practice limited liability with insurance. And in order for us to do that, we have to have commercial paper. So God comes along and says, now I want you to use gold and silver coin called just weights and balances and deal in property instead of commercial paper. And we said, God, you just don't understand. We have to fix your mistake. Now, we understand that you're kind of old-fashioned and you made these laws 3,100 years ago, not understanding the modern American economy. So we have to have insurance. We have to have unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, and a whole host and plethora of other limited liabilities that are furnished by government. In order to finance this, we have to have commercial paper like mortgages, bonds, stocks, Federal Reserve notes. And in order for us to have all of this, we then have to have taxes in order to support and pay for this government which oversees all of this limited liability, and the tax is on the dollars, not on your labor. And you see, you went in and signed a Social Security agreement. When you got your Social Security card, you agreed under the terms of the contract called the Social Security Act of 1935, codified at Title 42, Section 301 through 335. There's the contract. You see, most of you couldn't have found that contract at high noon with both hands and a roadmap, but now I just told you where it's at. Now you can go find it. You should read your contract, because that's the contract that takes 16.1% of everything you create and produce. And do you know that you couldn't pay an income tax without a Social Security number, because that's your taxpayer identification number? Did you know that? Oh, yeah, I'll show you that here in a couple of minutes. So labor is deemed to be property, but you don't have any property in your labor because you contracted it away. And this is especially true within the meaning of the constitutional guarantees, but of course your constitutional guarantees give way to your right to contract. So go to Article 1, Section 2, and you'll see that government is prohibited from interfering or impairing your right to contract. So you have a right to contract with Social Security, the government, or anybody else, and you can give away your rights. So the right to acquire property, then, includes the right to acquire property by labor. So you have a right to labor and to acquire property by labor. Why did you contract that right away? Why did you give it up? Well, for the same reason that people join the army. You see, you have a right to liberty, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and then you go down and sign an enlistment contract with the army and impair your liberty for 2, 4, or 6 years. Well, it isn't that you can't. I mean, everybody has a right to enslave himself if he so desires. In fact, a free man must have the capacity to enslave himself, because if he didn't have that capacity, he wouldn't be free. Ah. So the right to earn wages is just as much property and within the protection of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment to the Federal Constitution as are earned wages. So the fact that you're earning wages here at General Motors doesn't preclude you from the Bill of Rights and your right to earn wages, and your wages are property, unless or until you contract them away. Now, I would suspect that most of you people listening to me right now have a Social Security number, so you need to pay your income tax. Somebody's going to say, well, my God, you have to have a Social Security number. You couldn't get a job. Oh, no, no, that's not true. You can work anywhere you want without a Social Security number. Now, your employer told you you had to have a Social Security number, but you never litigated that, now, did you? Since the right to labor is protected by the 14th Amendment and numerous guarantees of state constitutions, one cannot be deprived of such right by arbitrary mandate of the legislature, and it merits legal protection. Congress could not enact a compulsory Social Security Act. Social Security isn't compulsory, it's voluntary. And it merits legal protection. Such right is likewise embraced by the 5th Amendment to the Federal Constitution. I don't have a Social Security number. I don't pay the income tax. I don't pay Social Security. But then I don't have any right to Social Security benefits. Now, isn't that just a drag? Now, listen to this. In Hale versus Hinkle, cited at 201 U.S. 43. Back in 1905, conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation and that he was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation with respect to the production of its books and papers, we're of the opinion that there is a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. The individual may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. He's entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. You, the individual, has power to contract, and it's unlimited. You, the individual, owe no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or open his doors to an investigation. You, the individual, you owe no duty to the state since you receive nothing therefrom. Yet, underline, you receive nothing therefrom. You see, everybody in America receives some benefit from government, and government is right there, Johnny, on the spot to offer you all of these benefits. Benefits. And the individual's rights are such as existed by the law of the land. That's called the common law, the law of the land, long antecedent to the organization of the state, and can only be taken from him by due process of law and in accordance with the Constitution. Now, on the other hand, the corporation, and when you get a Social Security number, you join this corporate capacity. And on the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state, and it's presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. So Joe, working at General Motors, is presumed to be for the benefit of the public. And you, Joe, receive certain special privileges and franchises. And you hold those subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of your charter. That's the limitations of your Social Security agreement. Now, your powers, Joe, once you have this Social Security number, or you, if you've created a corporation, your corporate powers are limited by law. Corporations can make no contracts not authorized by its charter. Now, take a look at this, Joe. Let's suppose you want to go to work without a hard hat and steel-toed shoes, and you want to work for less than minimum wage. Oh, no, 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 Joe. No, no. You're going to be fired from off the job. You see, you've got a contract with your employer and the United States government, the state, and the Social Security, the Department of Labor. You know, there's a lot of agencies that are involved in your contract, and they all agree that you have to wear a hard hat, steel-toed shoes, work for minimum wage. That's why we have wage and hour laws. And you follow all those wage and hour laws. You don't have any right or capacity to shed any of those laws. They're called protections. And you have to take them whether you want them or not. So the corporation's rights to act as a corporation are only preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws of its creator. And there's a reserved right in the legislature to investigate its contracts and to find out whether it's exceeded its powers. And that's why, Joe, when the IRS says, we want you to come in here and produce your records and books, you don't have any Fourth Amendment right to refuse to submit those books and records, which later can be used against you in the event that you haven't followed all of these thousands of rules and regulations under the Title 26 tax code. God, isn't that just kind of neat? Now listen, let me turn over here to a few letters from Social Security. You see, when you write a letter to the Social Security Administration and you rescind your Social Security number or your Social Security account, you'll receive a form letter back. Not everybody gets a form letter back. I didn't when I rescinded mine, but a lot of my students have over the years, and they have shared them with me. So here's one from one of my students from the Commissioner of Social Security. And it says, every worker is free to choose employment that is not covered by Social Security. Now, isn't that kind of neat? Now, you're probably sitting there saying, I cannot imagine a single job or a classification of employment in America that isn't covered by Social Security. Well, I can. In fact, the thing that makes your job covered by Social Security is whether or not you're acting in public business and whether or not you have a public contract. Now, I'm George Gordon, and I operate a private law school, and I don't have a Social Security number, and my law school is not covered by Social Security. I'm not entitled to the benefit, and this school is not open to the public. It is by invitation only, and it's private. And that's the difference between opening a school like the University of Missouri, whereas if I was working at the University of Missouri, which has a contract with the government, and all of their employees are in covered employment, and if I want to work there, then I have to have a Social Security number, but I don't have to work there at the University of Missouri. If I did, I'd have to pay income tax and Social Security. So I said, well, I don't want to pay that. I don't want to be subject to wage and hour laws. I want to have rights, freedoms, and I want to be independent. And in order to do that, I have to get into an area that is not covered by Social Security. So not every teacher in America is covered by Social Security, although most are. Now, Social Security, here's the second letter. Social Security is a voluntary system in that no one is required to get a number. Yeah, this is on Social Security. Social Security letterhead. And in my tax and status school, we're on chapter 21. Now, there's 46 lessons in my tax school. 46 things that you need to know about the income tax. And in order for you to make wise choices that will determine whether or not you give up Social Security or you keep it. I'm not here to tell you that you shouldn't have Social Security or that you shouldn't pay your income tax or that you should quit your job and go do something like I'm doing. I just open a school and give information and show you where the laws are, like Social Security is located at Title 42, Section 301 through 335, so that you can make a choice. Notice this, that no person, or however, a person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income. This is from Social Security. A person with no Social Security number would have no taxable income. And there's no law requiring a person to apply for a Social Security number, and there's no section of Title 18 of the U.S. Code making it a crime not to have a Social Security number. Now, here's a kicker. You'll love this one. This actually doesn't come from the Social Security Administration. It comes from Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce, cited at 168 Fed 2nd 709 on page 712. Listen to this. The revenue laws are a code or system in regulation of tax assessment and collection. They relate to taxpayers and not to non-taxpayers. And no procedure is prescribed for non-taxpayers, and no attempt is made to annul any of their rights and remedies in due course of law. With them, Congress does not assume to deal, and they're neither of the subject nor of the object of the revenue laws. Taxpayers and non-taxpayers recognized by Congress here in Stewart versus Chinese Chamber of Commerce. Now, if you'd like to learn more about the income tax, and if you'd like to drop out of the income tax system, I'd be more than happy to show you how to do that. But don't think for a moment now that you can do that just by making an announcement that I'm no longer a taxpayer. You know, people have been doing that for a long time, and they go to jail when they do. So remember the telephone number here at the law school, 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you want more information, go to my webpage, georgegordon.com. That's georgegordon.com. And if you'd like, just click onto the email machine, send me an email request, and we'd be more than happy to talk to you about our tax and status schools, give you a calendar, and tell you when the next school is going to be. All right, let's take a break here, and we'll come right back, and we'll take up this thing of courtroom strategy and procedure, because, you know, if you're going to drop out of the tax system, you might end up in federal court. And if you do, what are you going to tell the judge when he asks the question, how come you're not filing and paying your income tax, Joe? All right, let's shift gears here, and let's go to courtroom strategy and procedure. You know, 90% of the trial lawyers of America are incompetent. How do I know that? Because our Chief Justice, Warren E. Burger, back in 1978, speaking in Las Vegas, Nevada, to the National Association, or the National Bar Association, said 90% of the trial lawyers are incompetent. You know, if I could train you to be competent, you would be superior to 90% of the trial lawyers in America. There are 188 rules of evidence, 91 elements to code pleading, 47 extraordinary remedies, and 42 objections. Well, Judge Wenke made an observation. He said that in his 21 years on the bench, he met five trial lawyers who knew all 42 objections. That's like an NFL referee who knows, that would be like having a referee in Super Bowl who maybe knows half of the rules of football. Or worse yet, let's suppose there were five referees in the NFL who knew all of the rules of football. Come on, guys. Now, when you go into court, you are terrified. Everybody is. And why is that? Because it's mystery Babylon the Great. Nobody understands what's going on in there. The only guys that really know or are supposed to know are the judge and the lawyers. And you go in there, it's like going to Catholic church. You know, you walk in and all these people are in there and some guy's speaking in a foreign language. And these people are jumping up, sitting down, kneeling, and jumping up, sitting down, and kneeling. And everybody seems to know what to do and when to do it except you. You haven't got a clue as to what's going on. Well, that's the way court is. And it's a religious operation. That priest up there wearing that long robe, sitting on the bench, who is doing the ministrations of the church, the state religion. Nobody understands it. Everybody's terrified of it. We don't get caught up in it very often. When we do, we want to plead guilty, pay the fine, and get the hell out of there just as soon as we can. And 94% of the people who go into court and plead not guilty with a lawyer and defend their case lose. Now get that one again. Sharpen your pencil on both ends. Mark this down. 94% of the people who go into court with a lawyer, paid professional advice, plead not guilty with a lawyer, 94% lose, 6% win. Well, my observation was years ago that if you knew absolutely nothing, and walked into court, pled not guilty, defended yourself by getting on the witness stand and telling your story, you could improve your chances of winning from 6% to 16%. Those are the statistics. You don't have to hire a lawyer to lose. I did that. I hired an attorney, paid him $6,000 a year for 6 years, $36,000, did three cases, paid him $5,000 up front for the three cases. Now we're over $50,000, went into court and lost three cases. Woke up one day and I said, you know, I could go into court without a lawyer and lose free. Yeah, it doesn't cost anything to go into court and lose unless you hire a lawyer. Then it costs you a whole bunch to go into court and lose 94% of the time. Now, if you're a good, competent, trained pro se litigant, I mean, you know how to go into court and make your pleadings, get on the witness stand and tell your story, examine witnesses, cross-examine witnesses, and present your evidence, you'll win 86% of the time and lose 14. Not quite as good as the prosecutors who win 94 and lose 6. We will win 86 and lose 14. Now, you could go into court and do that, couldn't you? Now, what does a good lawyer look like? Because that's the first thing that your friends tell you. Whenever you get into legal trouble, they'll say to you without fail, Bob, what you need is a good lawyer. You need a good lawyer. What does a bad lawyer look like? What does a mediocre lawyer look like? Where do you find these good lawyers and mediocre lawyers? Well, looking at Corpus Juris Secundum, this is called CJS, Legal Encyclopedia. I'm in Volume 7, Section 4, the attorney-client relationship. Listen to what a lawyer's duty is. His first duty, that is the lawyer of a duty, his first duty is to the courts and the public, not to his client. Let me repeat that. The attorney that you just hired, paid him $5,000 cash up front, has three duties. The first is to the court, second is to the public, and the third is to you. His first duty is to the courts and the public, not to you, the client. And whenever his duties to his client conflict with those that he owes as an officer of the court in the administration of justice, the former must yield to the latter. So if the lawyer has to choose between the judge and you, you lose, the judge wins. If the lawyer has to decide between you and the public wins and you lose. I once talked to a public defender. His name was Larry. Larry, the public defender, had been a public defender for 6 years in Richmond, California. I asked him how many cases had he won for his clients, and he looked at me like I was Mork from Ork, and he said, it's not the duty or the job or the responsibility of a public defender to win his client's case. I was kind of surprised. I thought lawyers were there to win your case, whether he's a public defender working pro bono or working for a fee. And I said, well, gee, what is the public defender's job, Larry? And he said, the public defender's job is to protect his client's rights at every stage of the proceeding. Now, for you lay people, maybe you don't understand what that means in lay language. It means my job as a public defender is to protect your rights at every stage of the proceeding. If I succeed in my goal, I will eliminate every appealable error so that when you're convicted, there will be nothing for you to appeal on. It's my job as a public defender is to make sure that when the government convicts you, that conviction cannot be overturned. And that's why you have all these people on death row, many of them innocent, as you saw up in Illinois. And even though they're innocent, they cannot be relieved or they can't be reviewed. They can't have their cases reviewed or be released because there's no appealable error. Now, isn't that just special? Here's a second little thingy over here that you ought to know about your attorney, and that is a client, that's you, the client, is one who applies to a lawyer or a counselor for advice and direction in a question of law. So you don't know the law, so you go to a lawyer, and you pay him money, and he gives you advice and direction. Or you commit your cause to his management in prosecuting a claim, that's when you're the plaintiff, or defending against a suit in court, that's when you're the defendant. One who retains the attorney is responsible to him for his fees, so you have to pay this lawyer, and to whom the lawyer is responsible for the management of the suit. So the lawyer then is responsible to manage your suit for you. That's what you're paying him for. The person who communicates facts to an attorney expecting professional advice is called a client. Clients are also called wards of the court in regard to their relationship with their attorneys. So you create what's known as a guardian-ward relationship. You give your attorney your power of attorney. That's what that means. Power of attorney. You're going to give your power of attorney to your lawyer. He walks in and he defends you. If he loses, you have no right to complain because, after all, that was your guardian. Just like your daddy. Your daddy gets you your vaccinations. From your vaccinations, you have side effects. It's your daddy's responsibility, not the doctor, the hospital, or the pharmaceutical company, because, after all, he's your guardian. He decided that that was good for you to have those vaccinations. Listen to James Nielsen. He's a law professor at the Hastings Law School. And he's being used as an example by Jerry Spence in his book, With Justice for None. And here's Jerry Spence. He comes in and he says this. He says, I have taught young trial lawyers from across the land for many years in various trial seminars. And to my dismay, I find that most do not know how to conduct the simplest cross-examination or how to get an exhibit into evidence or to impeach a witness with a prior inconsistent statement. Jerry Spence makes $10 million a year as a lawyer. He's one of the 10% of the competent lawyers in America. From time to time, he holds trial seminars, and he instructs those incompetent 90% lawyers. And when he goes in there, he says, I've taught these young trial lawyers from across the land for many years in various trial seminars, and to my dismay, I find that most is 51%, most, over half, lack certain skills such as cross-examination or how to get an exhibit into evidence or to impeach a witness for a prior inconsistent statement. He says, these kinds of skills for an attorney are skills equivalent to a doctor being able to take a patient's blood pressure, examine his tonsils. Oh, wait a minute. Yet these lawyers, without the most rudimentary tools, are thrown into every kind of trial, from wrongful death suits for widows and children to the defense of capital murder cases for the accused. Then he goes on to cite James Nielsen, a professor at the Hastings Law School. He said, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. It's worse than that. How could it be worse than that? It's a fact, he says, that most students graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. Now, how in the hell can you graduate from law school without ever having seen a will, promissory note, contract, or a deed? And a student, he goes on to say, can graduate without ever having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. A student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. And he says, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, licensed lawyer issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, it is a cruel hoax, fraud, joke. Now, here at the law school, I have a different mission in life. Number one, I'm not trying to educate educated fools. So we don't take lawyers here. Lawyers don't come to law school here. Lawyers go to law school in law schools where they can get licensed, bonded, and insured. Now, I'm a lawyer. I'm just not licensed, bonded, or insured. I can go into court and represent myself all day long. I just can't go into court and represent you. So you can't hire me to represent you in court in your controversy. You can hire me to teach you the law so that you can go into court and represent yourself pro se. I'm also a plumber. I'm not licensed, bonded, or insured. I can't come out and fix your pipes. But you can come here to my plumbing school, and I can teach you plumbing. And then you can go down and get your own homeowner's permit and fix all the pipes in your house. Free. You don't have to pay a plumber. It's what we call do-it-yourself. Americans have been doing it themselves for many, many decades now. If you want to get the job done right, do it yourself. That's all. do it yourself. Now, I told you that I hired an attorney and paid him some money, went in and did some cases for me. He was a very good lawyer. He was in the real estate end of law. Lawyers specialize in law like doctors specialize in medicine. And no doubt he was a wonderful real estate attorney. Never had a complaint about him in his real estate function, but when he went into court to do a litigation, that is where he had to examine, cross-examine, make objections, and do a case, he wasn't very good. Of course, I didn't know in those days that some lawyers don't practice law in court. They practice law in their offices, writing contracts and doing those kinds of ministerial duties that make them a lot of money, but they never go into court to defend anybody. But, of course, they're licensed to go into court and defend, and so I went in as a plaintiff. And this guy, well, I went in as a plaintiff once, and he lost, and then I went in as a defendant twice, and he lost. So I had a good round of experience, and here's what I discovered. I discovered that after having paid the guy $50,000 over a period of 6 years, we did three litigations, and he lost three out of three. My common sense said to me, I could probably come in here and lose free. I couldn't do any worse, and I doubt if this guy can do any better. And meanwhile, I am paying to train him so that he can come into court and practice. People practice law. Did you ever notice that? They practice. Listen, when you hire a carpenter, a plumber, or an electrician, you don't expect this guy to come out and practice on your electric box or on your pipes. You expect him to know what he's doing and come out and fix them. Or to at least tell you it's not fixable, you need a new one. Now, here's a little illustration. You know, lawyers are entrepreneurs. Lawyers are in the business of making money. So Bob Jones University, some years back, they had a little problem. They needed to take it in, and they'd lost at the district court level. They lost at the appellate court level, and now the only hope they had left was to go to the United States Supreme Court. So they went into this prestigious law firm in Washington, D.C., and they said, hey, would you represent us in the U.S. Supreme Court? And this prestigious law firm said, for $236,000, we'll stand on our head in the corner and whistle Dixie through a straw hat. So they paid $236,000 to go into the Supreme Court on a discrimination case. Now, anybody who'd been to law school could have researched this out and told the people at Bob Jones, you can't win this case. This is already well settled in law. You're guilty. You broke the law. You're going to have to pay the piper. But the law firm didn't tell them that. The law firm instead said, oh, God bless you, because you are standing up for the Constitution, the First Amendment, and we will work our hearts out for you. And they probably did. On a losing case, took it to the Supreme Court, and indeed they did lose. That law firm knew or should have known that Bob Jones could not win. But if they'd have said, look, we've looked at your case and all of the transcripts, and we can tell you with certainty that if you go to the Supreme Court, you will lose again. So there's no need for you to spend $236,000 with our law firm to take up our time, effort, and energy, and to waste your money going into the Supreme Court to argue a case that can't be won. Law firms make money representing people, and remember, half the people lose and half the people win, and the lawyers win on either side, just like a stockbroker. He doesn't care whether you're buying or whether you're selling. He makes money every time you trade. So let's understand that lawyers are entrepreneurs and lawyers are liars. And a lawyer will never tell you that you have a losing case any more than a stockbroker will tell you don't buy that stock because it's a loser. That stockbroker is in the business of selling stock. So if you've got the stock, he's going to tell you, sell it, so I can make a commission, and if you don't have the stock, he's going to tell you to buy it because he's going to make a commission. He is never going to tell you the truth. And that's why lawyers are reported to be liars. That is, people instinctively know lawyers cannot be trusted. Now let me tell you a little story here about pleadings. You know, the most important element in the case is this thing called pleadings. You go into court, you know that you're going to plead guilty or not guilty. Nobody tells you, including the judge, that you could also stand mute, plead nolo contendere, plead double jeopardy, make a plea in abatement, or plead non-assumpsit by way of confession and avoidance. Nobody tells you that. Nobody tells you, for instance, that there's a general demur and a special demur, and that instead of pleading, you could demur, and a demur, in effect, is an answer to the complaint. Nobody tells you to answer the complaint and to set up your own defense. Why is that? Well, because there's a thing here called the major and minor premise. Now, the minor premise is this. The prosecutor comes in and he says, you haven't paid your child support. You haven't paid your taxes. And you come in and you plead not guilty and reduce the controversy to a single clear-cut issue of law or fact. If it's an issue of fact, the jury can hear it. And if it's an issue of law, the jury can't hear the issue of law. Only the judge can. And, of course, nobody explained that to you either. And you could have learned all this in the 9th and 10th grades in high school, but nobody taught it to you. I have people tell me, well, Mr. Gordon, you're pretty smart, you know. You can go into court and you can do all this, and that's because you're real smart, you know. Oh, no. Oh, no. I'm not real smart. I'm a high school dropout. I've done 62 cases, and I've won 54. Now, I lost 8. You can't win them all. But my win-loss percentage is around 86%. My wife now has done 17 cases over the last 19 years, and she's won 17 out of 17. She had a little better advice than I had when I did my 62. And I do cases every now and again yet to this day. And our win-loss percentage is about the same. And I can tell you in plain language, like I did the guy who came to me. He was a polygamist down in Murray, Utah, and he said, I've got 3 wives, or at least this was the guy that was representing the committee, his defense committee, that were raising money from the public at large. That's all the polygamists. And said, well, we would like to take this case all the way to the United States Supreme Court. What do you think? And so I researched it out, and I came back, and I said, well, I got some good news, and I got some bad news. Let me ask you a couple of questions here. And he said, well, go ahead. And I said, well, is this Murray, Utah policeman married with a marriage license? And he said, oh, yes, yes. He's legal and lawful and bona fide and licensed and insured and has 3 marriage licenses with his 3 wives. I said, okay. I said, if by chance, could any of these 3 women be related, such as sisters? And he said, oh, yeah, 2 of them are sisters. And I said, okay. Well, in that case, then, we don't need to go any further. I don't need to waste your time. You don't need to waste mine. You cannot win this case. You are going down in flames. You're in violation of both the civil law and the common law. You do not have a religious free exercise argument to make because you've got licenses, number one, and you're in violation of the biblical prohibition against marrying sisters. And this has already been adjudicated in Reynolds versus U.S., and because of that, you're going down in flames and you're going to lose. Now, the law does not prohibit polygamy. I want to emphasize that. In the United States of America, there's no law against polygamy. There is a law against practicing plural marriages with a marriage license, but there's no law against having 2 wives, 6 wives, or 9 wives with no marriage license. So for all of you Mormon polygamists out there, if you have a marriage license with 1 or more of your plural wives, you're in violation of the law. You're in violation of the law of God because you got a marriage license, and you're in violation of the state because you have a contract and you're in breach of contract. It's just that simple. That's what I told the man. And he was sad, and he went away sad, and they went ahead and hired a law firm, and they took the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that case, along with the Reynolds case, demonstrates just exactly what I told you, and that is, he lost. Difference is, I didn't take his money for no good purpose, but the law firm that represented him also knew they were going to lose. But they told him, you just pay your money and come on in here, son, and we'll just argue and we'll just plead and jump up and down, paw the ground, bite the bushes, and do all those things that lawyers are supposed to do to make you feel real good about us. And we'll do everything we can to win, knowing full well that they were going to lose. Now, let me show you a little something here from Chapter 19, Coffler Repi, on considerations preliminary to the classification of defenses. Let me tell you a little story. Let's suppose an MP comes in here and he says to me, George Gordon, you're under arrest for being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. And I say, well, it's true. My name is George Gordon. And now that you're going to arrest me, are you going to take me to the grand jury in Springfield? Are you going to take me up for a preliminary hearing? Are you going to take me in for an arraignment? No, 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 none of the above. I'm going to go right straight to the brig in Fort Lewis, Washington. Am I going to get due process and equal protection under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights? No, no, no. I'm going to be prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ. But you say, well, wait a minute, that violates your constitutional rights. No, 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 it doesn't violate my constitutional rights. And if I want to assert my constitutional rights, then I'm going to have to be smart enough to come into this military court and defend. If I'm going to be smart enough to come into this patent court, then I'm going to have to be smart enough to defend. You have to know the rules of court. So I come up before the provost marshal, and he says, now, Sergeant Gordon, you've been charged with a violation of 2204 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice in that you're absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington. How do you plead to that charge? And the minute I plead not guilty from that moment on, I cannot win. And neither can you. And when you walk into court and the judge says, how do you plead today, guilty or not guilty? If you plead guilty, you cannot win. If you plead not guilty, you cannot win. If you plead nolo contendere, you cannot win. All right, now you understand that? So when a judge is asking you the question, how do you plead to this charge, he's asking you, do you want the red death pill or the green death pill? It's up to you to be smart enough to say, well, I think I'll pass on both the red and the death green pills. I think I'll take the white life pill, and I think I will answer the complaint with a general demur. And if the judge says, my God, demurs are abolished in federal practice. Okay, but a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case isn't. And that's all that has been changed here from a general demur to a motion to dismiss under Rule 56-12b-6, or a motion to dismiss for failure of the state to prove its prima facie case. The names have changed, but the procedures are identical. Now, of course, nobody's explaining that to you now in the 9th and 10th grades, but let me explain it to you. You see, when the prosecutor comes in, he writes up a complaint which contains what's called the minor premise. And that's because if it's assumed that every liability consists of two elements, called a given combination of facts or events, plus a rule of substantive law attaching legal consequences to those facts or events. And if it be remembered that in order to state a good cause of action, one need only set out the combination of facts. One need only set out the combination of facts. One need only set out the combination of facts and events. And that's all the prosecutor does. He doesn't sit there and explain how you're in violation of the law. He just sets out the combination of facts and events. The court then takes judicial notice of the rule of law without its statement, and the question arises, in how many ways may the defendant resist the alleged liability asserted in the declaration? And the answer is two. Two. You get two things you're going to do. You're going to plead or demur. That's it. If you plead, you're only going to plead guilty or not guilty, because the judge is never going to tell you that you have the right to stand mute, plead nolo contendere, plead double jeopardy, plea in abatement, or a plea of non-assumpt by way of confession and avoidance. He's just like a carpet salesman. You know, the carpet salesman asks you, do you want the high-low carpet or the shag? He asks you, do you want the green carpet or the red carpet? Do you want to pay with cash or check? You know, he doesn't ask you what you want. He gives you an alternative to choose from. Either alternative, he wins and you lose. And besides that, the judge is working for the state. So pay attention now, boys and girls. When you walk into court and you're looking for a fair trial, you're not going to get it in court, not unless you know how to create a fair trial. Let's try this one on for size. You walk into court and you've got a complaint, and the complaint says that you haven't paid your child support, and the complaint says the state of California versus Joe Sixpack. Who is the complaining party? It's the state of California. The state of California is complaining about your behavior or your failure to behave properly. And the state then brings you into state court. This is called a superior court in California, and you go before a state trial judge. This state trial judge is being paid every Friday by who? Who pays the judge's salary? Who's paying the judge's salary? It's the state of California. The state of California is complaining about your behavior. And then the state of California takes you in to the court of the state of California. So the state of California takes you into the state court in front of the state judge who's being paid on Friday by the state of California, the party who's complaining about your behavior. Now there's another guy in there called a prosecutor. This prosecutor is prosecuting you, and the prosecutor says, I'm here to put you away for the full term. You're a criminal, and I'm going to lay you away. Who's paying his salary? Ah, the complaining witness, the state of California. The state of California. Ah, and now we need a witness against you. Who is this witness against you? It's the policeman, the IRS agent. It's the employee of who? The state of California. Now the judge looks at you and says, Joe, maybe you don't understand the proceedings that are going on here. Maybe you're confused. And we just want to help. We just want to protect and serve. And so, at no cost to you whatsoever, we're going to appoint the public defender. Yes, sir, we're going to give you the public defender who's going to come in at no cost to you, which is a lie. And the public defender is being paid by who? Yeah, that's right, the state of California. Now, here you got the state of California brings you into the state's court in front of the state's judge, being prosecuted by the state's prosecutor. The witnesses against you are state agents who are being paid by the state, and then your defense lawyer is licensed by the state or is working and being paid by the state. And this is called a fair trial. Come on, Joe. Come on, Joe. If you're not brain dead, pay attention. This is not a fair trial, Joe. You need to get rid of that public defender. You need to come in here with some knowledge of the rules so that you can apply the rules. You know, there's 7 pleas you could make. There are 2 demurs you could make. There's an answer to the complaint you could make. You know, Joe, if you grow up and get wise in a hurry, you could probably go in there and win 84% of the time. Now, that's the purpose for the Gordon Law School. Now let's go back here to the soldier. Let me ask you a question. Do you think that the charge of being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, is a fair charge? Well, let me tell you, it's not only fair, it's true, accurate, and correct, because my name is George Gordon, and I am absent from Fort Lewis, and I don't have anybody's permission from Fort Lewis, Washington, to be right here today where I am. So if somebody came in here and charged me with being absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, factually, that's true. Legally, that's false. Because there are 2 defenses, the minor premise and the major premise. The minor premise is George Gordon is absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, but the major premise is George Gordon doesn't have an enlistment contract with the United States Army, and this court doesn't have jurisdiction. Now, many people get mixed up over this jurisdiction thing, so let me hit it with you, or let me explain it to you just quickly. It is true that when you challenge jurisdiction, it is the burden then of the court or the prosecution to come in and prove jurisdiction. But, you know, walking into court, folding your arms, and saying, I challenge the jurisdiction of this court is not a jurisdictional challenge. Yeah, let me repeat that. Just announcing to the court that you're challenging the jurisdiction of the court is not a jurisdictional challenge, and the judge doesn't say a word. He just listens, and he's waiting for you to make the next statement. And I am prepared to offer witnesses, evidence, and testimony to prove that, and my first witness is. And then when you produce the witnesses, evidence, and testimony to prove that the court doesn't have jurisdiction, that is, that with a subpoena deuces tecum, you come in and demand that the prosecutor bring in the enlistment contract, and when he fails to do that, you move to dismiss in summary judgment because the state cannot prove their prima facie case, and that is that you're absent without leave from Fort Lewis, Washington, because the first objective has to prove that you're a soldier in the Army. And nobody has to raise the issue of whether or not you're a soldier unless you raise it in your own defense. And that's the purpose for pleadings. And if you can't get your pleadings correct, you can't win the case. All right, now there's 28 things that you have to know in courtroom strategy and procedure. I've just kind of touched the tip of the iceberg here to give you an idea of what it is you have to do, what it is you're going to have to learn. 28 things. I covered a couple of them. Now, in order for you to learn more, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, just go to my webpage. It's georgegordon.net, georgegordon.net, or you can hit com or org. It doesn't really make any difference. We got them all, but georgegordon.net. Click onto the email machine. That'll be my email address. Send us an email request for more information, and we'd be happy to give it to you. All right, I'm at the end of this disc. Let's change the disc over here, and we'll come back, and we'll take a look at another topic in the 8 schools here at the Gordon Law School. Maybe we'll take up private business next. That sounds like a good one. Private business. Let's take up private business. What is business? Well, in the ordinary course of life and business, we call it commerce. In the Bible, we see the Canaanite traffickers, people who traffic, or people who deal in commerce. The Bible specifically prohibits commerce, but not trade. What's the difference between trade and commerce? Well, the Commerce Clause in the United States Constitution is an Achilles heel. It gives Congress the power to regulate commerce, trade, commerce, business, and industry that affects a public interest can be regulated and controlled by government. And we see that in Wickard versus Filburn, cited at 317 U.S. 111. Wickard versus Filburn. Here's the story. A guy by the name of Filburn is a farmer in Indiana. In 1938, during the Depression years, the government came along with a price support program for wheat. And they said, look, sign up and we'll pay 96 cents a bushel. Now, you're going to get 56 cents a bushel. We'll give you 40 cents more if you'll sign up for this price support regulatory program. And so Filburn signed up. Now, when he signed up, he got paid 96 cents a bushel, but he was limited to 20 acres. So he signed a contract, and he says, I agree that I'll grow no more than 20 acres of wheat, and you'll agree that you'll pay me 96 cents a bushel for every bushel that I harvest. There's the deal. Works in 39, 40, 41. But in 1941 or 42, Mr. Filburn planted 40 acres of wheat. 40. Twice as much as his allotment called for. Now, he took 20 acres, harvested it, and he sold it into commerce, and he took 20 acres and fed it to his turkeys. So he did not sell 40 acres of wheat into commerce. He took 20 acres and he used that for his turkeys. When the government got wind of it, they prosecuted Mr. Filburn. He took the case clear to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court came back and said this. It is hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. Ah, so it tells us the first chain or the first link in the chain is commerce. So government can regulate that which it subsidizes. So when government gives you a benefit, government then sets down the rules. Well, then if you wanted to stay out of commerce, out from under the rulemaking body at Article 1, Section 8, the Commerce Clause, then you'd have to stay out of the contractual arrangement with government. That's private business. You see, Mr. Filburn could raise all the wheat in the world. He could have 100 acres, 1,000 acres, 1,000,000 acres, and take it out into the marketplace and sell it. But once he took the government benefit, he also took the government regulation. And you know, that's what everybody does when they get a business license. People get a business license, and then they complain about the regulatory schemes that government comes in and regulates that business by. You see, we didn't have regulation in business in 1900. And that's because the businessmen in 1900 didn't receive any government benefits. Now let's take a look at a second aspect of this called the adhesion contract. You know, people in the Patriot community have been battling statutes requiring specific performance for years and with wide and varying results. Now, one of the great generalizations about social history is the thesis of Sir Henry Maine that the history of progressive societies may be described as a movement from status to contract. We Americans, over the past century, have made a conscious move from the status of common law free man to the status of businessman. And in the process, we wanted to conduct business in commerce with commercial instruments. Well, when you do that, if you're going to do business in banks, buy stocks and bonds, have equitable interests, then those activities have to be regulated and controlled for the benefit of all of the participants, including the public at large. And that's, of course, the business of government. And so government comes in with the Securities and Exchange Commission and regulates stocks and stock sales, bonds and bond sales, and corporations and corporate business. And, of course, along comes the sales tax and the income tax, and, of course, mandatory insurance and all kinds of regulations that regulate each and every aspect of these businesses, you know, like OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, IRS, and so on. Now, I operate a small private business here called the Gordon Law School. I don't have a business license. I don't deal in commercial paper. Tuition here at the school is paid in gold. We do business with people through private contract. We don't receive any government benefits. And because we don't participate in commerce, we don't have the regulations and the controls that ordinary businesses that do, in fact, deal in trade, commerce, business, and industry do have. Now, a contract of adhesion is summed up in an insurance policy. You see, an insurance policy is an adhesion contract. A driver's license is an adhesion contract. It is a contract that is imposed upon a vast host of vassals. And with the decline of the free enterprise system due to the innate trend of competitive capitalism towards monopoly, the meaning of contract over the past century has radically changed. Society, when granting freedom of contract, does not guarantee that all members of the community will be able to make use of contract to the same extent. On the contrary, the law, by protecting the unequal distribution of property, does nothing to prevent freedom of contract from becoming a one-sided privilege. Society, by proclaiming freedom of contract, guarantees that it will not interfere with the exercise of power by contract. Freedom of contract enables enterprisers to legislate by contract, and what's even more important, to legislate in a substantially authoritarian manner without using the appearance of authoritarian forms or means. Standard contracts in particular could thus become effective instruments in the hands of powerful industrial and commercial overlords, enabling them to impose a new feudal order of their own making upon a vast host of vassals. And the development of large-scale enterprise with its mass production and distribution inevitably led to a standardized mass contract. And the usefulness of these contracts was discovered in the banking, insurance, and transportation businesses, and their use spread to all other fields of large-scale enterprise and into international as well as national trade and into labor relations. And it's this uniformity of the terms of contracts which has become such an important factor in the precise calculation of risks. Risks which are difficult to calculate may be eliminated altogether. So therefore, the standard clauses in insurance policies are the most striking examples of this attempt to select and control risks assumed under contracts. All right, now watch how adhesion contracts work. Now, an adhesion contract is a contract that is binding upon you that you don't know the terms and conditions of. So, for instance, you go into the bank to buy a house. The bank finances your house and requires as one of its terms and conditions that you buy homeowners insurance and fire insurance. And when you go down and you buy the insurance, you don't read that policy. You could, but you don't. So you don't know what the terms and conditions are. Well, one of the terms and conditions is that you're going to keep full coverage on the house. So as the house appreciates in value, you're supposed to increase the amount of insurance coverage. So if you have a fire in the house, like as not, it's going to be a $14,000 average kitchen fire. So you buy a $100,000 house, and you insure the house for $100,000, but over the years, the price of the house goes up to $200,000. Now you have a $14,000 kitchen fire. The insurance company pays you $7,000, 50% of the value of the house. And you sit there and say, that isn't fair, that isn't right. Well, that's what commerce is all about, and that's what adhesion contracts are all about, and that contract was written by the legal department of the insurance company and the banking industry. Like it or not, those are the terms and conditions of the adhesion contract. Now, let me show you the value of using gold and silver coin. When you come to school here, we will charge you gold coin. For instance, normal people would say they want $1,500 to go to school here. I would say to you that I want $225 or $90. $90 in gold coin paid to me in $20 double eagles. That's 4.5 ounces of gold. That's 4.5 ounces. People will ask me, well, how much does school cost? Well, it costs 9 ounces for the 2-week schools, and it costs 4.5 ounces for the 1-week schools. How many dollars, they want to know? Well, the answer is it depends upon whether you use the $50 eagle or the $20 double eagle. And people say, no, I want to know how many dollars. Oh, you want to know how many Federal Reserve Note dollar units. Yes. Well, if you went to buy a $20 double eagle today, it would probably cost you around $340. Therefore, you need approximately 4.5 of those to come to school here, which would be in the neighborhood of $1,500. Or you would need 4.5, and it'll be just maybe a little bit less than that. Let's say it's $325 to buy the eagles. Those are $50 denominated gold coins, and it'll cost you probably $100 less than that. Now, somebody says to me, well, how much if I just write you a check? Oh, we don't take checks. Well, why don't you take checks? Well, you see, if I were to take your check for $1,500, the minimum filing requirement for me is $7,200. So let's just go through that. That's $15,000, $30,000, $45,000, $6,000, $7,500. I would go over the $7,200 filing minimum with 5 students, wouldn't I? Ah, but if I take $225, you see, $225 divided into $7,200, or if I took $90 divided into $7,200, all of a sudden I could take 72 students, or about 40 students, or 5 students. Can you follow that? Now, I have to follow all the laws of the United States and all the laws of Missouri and all the laws of God, and I have to do all that at the same time. I can do that. I can do that. I can't do it as a commercial merchant operating in trade, commerce, business, and industry with a business license trying to function under the Roman civil law, but I can practice the Mosaic law, the common law, and I can do that by using gold and silver coin, which is what I do. Now, some years back, I received a letter from the Missouri Bureau of Industrial Relations or Vocational Education. I think it was the Missouri Department or Bureau of Vocational Education. And they said to me, you're operating a law school and you don't have, we look through our files and we can't find a license for you anywhere. So they sent me some literature and invited me to joining into the licensing scheme of the state of Missouri. So I wrote them a nice 9-page letter back and I said, gee, I really don't want to participate. You see, under Wickard versus Filburn, if I were to get a license, then I would be regulated and controlled by the state. Now, many people believe that all state or all business activity is regulated by the state. That's not true. No. See, under our Constitution, everybody in the country is free until he impairs his liberty to some degree by creating a license, a benefit, a permit. So I can't have the benefits that come from this licensing program. In other words, I can't get the 96 cents a bushel. I can't have that extra 40 cents a bushel. But I can grow as many acres of wheat as I desire. And I can charge my customers whatever the market price will bear. Or I can lower my prices. For instance, I could work for $1 an hour. You can't. You see, you're regulated by minimum wage laws. So while you have to be paid $5 an hour, I could work for one silver dollar an hour, which is worth $7 an hour, you see, in Federal Reserve notes. Or I could work for $5 an hour, which is minimum wage, paid to me in gold coin, which has a commercial trade value out in the marketplace of about 40 Federal Reserve note dollars. And that's because of the Coinage Act of 1964, which was codified in Title 31, Section 5101 through 5112 of the U.S. Code. Why don't we take a look at that? We'll flip over here to 5101. Title 31, the United States money is expressed in dollars, dimes, and tenths. Cents or hundredths, mills or thousandths, and a dime is a tenth of a dollar, a cent is a hundredth of a dollar, and a mill is a thousandth of a dollar. That's Title 31, Section 5101. Now, in Section 5102, the standard troy pound of the National Bureau of Standards of the Department of Commerce shall be the standard used to ensure that the weight of the United States coins conforms to specifications in Section 5112 of this title. And 5103 gives us a little more information and tells us that United States coins and currency, including Federal Reserve notes and circulating notes of Federal Reserve banks and national banks, are legal tender for all debts, public charges, taxes, and dues. Foreign gold or silver coins are not legal tender for debts. So Congress comes along and says, okay, now, Mr. Gordon, if you would like to, you can take a $20 double eagle and you can pay your property taxes with that. And I have to go in and pay, if I wanted to buy one of those, 340 Federal Reserve notes. So I could go in and pay my taxes with 340 Federal Reserve notes, or I could convert that to one $20 double eagle and I would get $20 worth of tax credit for 1 ounce of gold. Isn't that just special? Now, a lot of times people look at me and they say, God, you're stupid. Why, you're just a dum-dum. Why, you don't have any brains at all. And that's why people with more intelligence than I have deal in commercial paper, stocks and bonds, and they buy Enron and WorldCom and Global Crossing and fools like me we're not smart enough to do business in trade, commerce, business, and industry, and we miss out on all of the profit and gain that comes from all of these neat activities in the stock market and bonds and so on. But as a little trade-off over here, when I take this $20 double eagle from my student, he goes out and he pays $340 and he gets that $20 double eagle. So I charge him four and a half of those, and I can get 360 of those. Just try it. Just divide 20 into $7,200, the minimum filing requirement, and you'll get 360. Now, if I take one of those $20 double eagles down to my gold broker and I say, Charlie, I would like you to trade this in for me. I'd like to give you this $20 gold piece. It's a real neat one. And how many Federal Reserve notes will you give me? And he won't give me 340, but he'll give me about 320 or 315. And then somebody says, my God, Gordon, you are dumb. Now, look, you know, you'd be better off if you just charged $1,500 each time. Well, I discovered years ago that when I pay $1,500 or I collect $1,500, then I have to pay an income tax. And if I do very many of those transactions in a year's time, it could cost me as much as $42,000 in income tax and another $15,000 in Social Security taxes, which is around, $57,000 out of my $100,000 income, which only leaves me with about $43,000. So one day I woke up and I said, my God, what would happen if I just took the $20 double eagle, gave you credit at it for 340 Federal Reserve notes, charged you 4.5 ounces, took in $90, divided that into 7,200, I could get 360 of those. 360 $20 double eagles has the purchasing power of $117,000 in Federal Reserve notes. And since it's under $7,200, there is no tax return and $0 of taxes. And then, since I've rescinded my Social Security account, and I don't participate in Social Security and don't participate under Wickard versus Filburn in commerce, I don't have to pay that Social Security tax. Of course, then when I get to be an old man, I'll starve to death because I won't have any way to make a living, and I'll be old and full of years. And you see, I won't have any Social Security. And that's where I'm at right now. You see, in my high school class, all of my high school friends and neighbors and relatives, see, they all are retired now on Social Security, living their lives happily ever after on the dole, and George Gordon has no Social Security, so I have to keep working. I can't retire ever. I know it's terrible, but that's the trade-off that you make. So I get $117,000 a year in purchasing power under that $7,200. Can you follow that? Now, if I take $50 double eagles, I get about $40,000 worth of purchasing power. So, like I said, what goes around comes around. And I make it a point to participate in gold coin and silver coin so that I don't have to pay that tax. Flip over here to 5112, and I'll show you the law. Gold coins is in 5112. A, and then down here in silver dollars is 5112E. Now take a look at G. This is 5112G. For purposes of section 5132A1 of this title, all coins minted under subsection E of this section shall be considered to be numismatic items. So the coins that I deal in are called numismatic coins. Numismatic. That means that the people's fear, you know, that they're going to confiscate your gold. That's fine. Remember they said they don't confiscate your gold if it's numismatic? Well, Congress was very nice to us, and they gave us this numismatic clause in 5112G. And then legal tender. Look at this. H, 5112H, the coins issued under this title shall be legal tender as provided in Section 5103 of Title 31 of the U.S. Code. So I've got numismatic coins, legal tender, and they are legal tender for all debts, public and private. So I can take those in at face value, and I can spend them at face value. And when I spend them at face value, I get $117,000 worth of purchasing power for $7,200. So when God told us to use just weights and balances, you'll see that in Leviticus 19:35 and 36, he wasn't whistling Dixie through a straw hat. Furthermore, the laws of the United States always comport perfectly with the laws of the Bible. You'll never find the United States government or any state government or any city or municipality, county, or other political subdivision that violates the law of God. So if you can practice the Mosaic law and do that to perfection, you can also comply with all the laws of the United States, because we have a clause in our Constitution, First Amendment, called the Free Exercise Clause. All right. Now, if you would like to learn more about how to do private business so that you can comply with the income tax laws and all the rest of the laws of the country, call me at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or just go to my webpage, georgegordon.com. That's georgegordon.com. Click on to the email and send me an email request. That's all there is to it. Now let's take up a second topic over here called family. All right, here we go again. We're on marriage is a licensed business. And anytime you get a license, you're engaged in some kind of an illegal activity, because a license by definition is permission to do something that's illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. So what is family law all about? Well, family law is that body of law that is regulated under the marriage license. And there are courts that just deal with family law. We call them divorce courts, but they're typically called family courts. And they deal with such things as the guardian-ward relationship, parents patre, custody standards, custody, marriage, divorce, separation, alimony, child support. But there are literally thousands of laws that regulate this industry called marriage. For instance, you have to have your children immunized in order to send them to public school. They have to be sent to public school because we have compulsory education laws. And these laws are enacted by the legislature in conformance to, or a part of, or as a part of the marriage business. There was a time in marriage when, or in America, when we didn't have marriage licenses. Prior to 1876, when Illinois became the first state to start issuing marriage licenses on a large scale, general application for marriage licenses, even as far back as 1900, you know, just 25 years later, marriage licenses were not common. But by 1920, they were common. By 1940, they're practically universal. Today, if somebody is married without a marriage license, people kind of look at them with tongue in cheek and say, oh my God, that's a common law marriage. Or they're just living together, or they're shacked up, or they don't have a real marriage. Well, going back in time, did we have real marriages when Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were running around on the planet, or were all of their marriages just funny marriages? And their children were all bastards because, after all, they weren't married. Where would Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Daniel, or any of those people have gone to get a marriage license? Well, they would have gone to the king. They'd have gone to the state. Marriage licenses aren't something new. They're new in Anglo-Saxon administration, but they're not new in pagan mythology, ideology, government, politics, or religion. You know, the ancient Babylonians and Egyptians and Sumerians all went to the king to get permission to marry, because marriage is a business. It's a family business, to be sure, but it's a business. And today, it's big business, and it's regulated by the state. Now, this marriage is a three-party limited general partnership. That is, the boy, the girl, and the state. It's by, for, and among, and between all three of these parties. And the marriage license is proof of that contract. A common law marriage is a two-party contract between the boy and the girl. It's by, for, among, and between the two parties. There may be or there may not be a formal written instrument as proof of the contract. The agreement to contract is by penetration, that's consensual sexual intercourse, and agreement. It is not universally recognized, and where it is recognized, such as in Texas, the states assume jurisdiction by way of birth certificates. And when it's recognized by the state, there is very little difference between a common law marriage and a civil law marriage. Now, a patriarchal marriage, which comes from the scripture, is a two-party contract between the boy and the girl's father. The female is not a contracting party. The contract is for a limited purpose, and that is of transferring guardianship of the female from the father to the husband. The girl's father gives away his daughter in a public ceremony. The contract terminates upon consummation. The consummation is the proof of the marriage. And upon consummation, the boy accepts all of the liabilities of the girl's father. And under Hebrew law, the females must be taken care of from the cradle to the grave. So the female is a liability which is transferred to the husband. The female is the object of the contract, not a contracting party. Kind of a wild new concept, isn't it? Now, there are various standards for custody. And custody is predicated upon the doctrine of parens patre. So let's take a look at who owns this child. So let me make this statement. No female on planet Earth in the entire history of mankind has ever owned a child. Let me repeat that. No female on this planet has ever owned a child. No female on this planet's ever going to own a child. And that's because fathers can own children and states can own children. That is, the king can own your child, mother, or your husband can own your child, but you can't. Now, in America today, neither the father or mother own the child. The state owns the child, and it comes under the doctrine of parens patre. Now, the origin of the doctrine of parens patre in the law can be traced to medieval and late medieval English chancery courts, where it played an important role in the maintaining of the structure of feudalism. Chancery, as an agent of the monarchy, had a duty to assure the orderly transfer of feudal duties from one generation to another, and to ensure that there would be someone available to perform these duties, and the concept of parens patre was usually invoked in connection with problems of property or guardianship. Now, in some of the colonial statutes, we can see the beginnings of the idea that children are to be protected not only from poverty, but also from parents who are undeserving. Now, who determines whether a parent is undeserving? Well, Lord Redesdale maintained that parents have rights to their children only as a privilege granted by the state, and the state delegates control over children to their parents as a trust, and that it does so because parents usually discharge this trust faithfully on behalf of their children. Again, who decides who an unfit parent is? Oh, that's done by the state. Now, the right of parental control is a natural but not an unalienable one, and in the trust referred to by Lord Redesdale, the settlor, or the creator of the trust, is the state. The trustee is presumably the child's natural parents, and the beneficiary of the trust, or the sesticui trust, is called the minor child. The fiduciary relationship does not rule out the satisfaction of interests that parents have as individuals. But they may not criticize these standards on the grounds that the parents are a specific child's parents and that they know what is best for their own child. You know, mothers and daddies, the concept that you know what's best for your child resides with the state, not with you. And the reason that the state comes in and determines these kinds of facts is because you have a marriage license in which you invited the state into your marriage as a third party. That is, the boy, the girl, and the state. So you have a three-party limited general partnership in which the state is a one-third party and has a one-third property right or interest in the profits that are generated by the family, by the marriage. So when mom and dad get married with a state marriage license, and then mom and dad produce children, motorcycles, snow machines, condominiums, houses, businesses, property. When dad dies, mama says, oh, goody, I get all the toys. And the state comes in and says, oh, no, mommy, buy me out. So what does buy me out mean? It means pay the inheritance tax, mommy. Because, you see, there's three of us involved in this partnership, and now the partnership has been dissolved by the death or by the divorce of one of the parties. Therefore, pay me. So the state comes in and regulates the custody, for which there are 12 custody standards. You see, parens patriae is created by the state, and then the state comes up and says, okay, now we're going to develop these standards by which the state will determine custody. Isn't that just real special? I knew you'd love it. Now, when we talk about custody, then, we're talking about 12 standards that the state develops to make a determination as to who should have this child. Who should have custody of the child, the mother or the father. Now, when the state comes in and makes that determination, they make it in the child's best interest. Or do they make it in the state's best interest and call it the child's best interest because it sounds better for public relations? In any event, the following is a list of the 12 items a family court judge will look for when determining a person's fitness to have physical and or legal custody of a minor child. These are not put in any specific order, as each court, indeed each judge, will weigh these differently. And also some courts and or judges will have additional items which they may use. However, we know of no family court that doesn't start with these 12 items. Number one is called the moral character. Usually the judge will consider the moral character of all those seeking custody as well as any individuals with whom they live. Two, financial ability. This is used to determine a party's ability to provide a financially stable environment. During divorces, the wife's financial ability is based on, or at least in part, just how much money can she expect to be paid by her husband in alimony and child support. So when this issue comes up, like financial ability, you know, if you stop and think about it for a moment, you know, men actually have the better financial ability to support the child than do mothers. Ah, well then why is it that mothers get custody 96.5% of the time and fathers 3.5% of the time? Well, that's because the state is really the father, and the father is a eunuch, and the state comes in and says, here's who I want to raise my child. And so the state, who owns the child by way of the birth certificate, had a one-third interest with the marriage license, and when you got the birth certificate, you and your wife gave 100% of the child to the state. And you did that for a benefit. Remember, under Wickard versus Filburn, you wanted to be able to collect food stamps, welfare, and send your child to free public school, free public education. That's just three of the many benefits that you receive from the state as a partner with the state in your family business. Isn't that real neat? So now the state comes in under Wickard versus Filburn, and they regulate the terms and conditions of this marriage. And they regulate it because, after all, they own it, don't they? Number three, parental affection. Number four, child rearing skills. Number five, child training skills. Number six, the best interests of the child. And then the ability to provide the necessities of life. This goes beyond mere financial ability to cover those items which cannot be quantified financially. A person with lots of money who can't be bothered to buy good shoes for their child may pass the financial ability test but fail this one. Formal education. In contested issues of custody, the general rule is that, all other items being equal, the more educated a party is, the better their chances of keeping or getting custody. So those of you that have a PhD, or you have a master's degree, or you have a college degree, just picture this, Daddy. You've got a master's degree in business administration, you're financially able, and the mother, in this case, maybe is a high school graduate or a high school dropout, and there's a contested issue over custody, and that is you want custody of the child. Hey, listen. All things being equal, you got a better shot at getting custody than does the mother. And I don't care, from my point of view here at the law school, whether you're male or female. Everybody has a constitutional right to the child. That's right, a constitutional right to that child. That means that you fathers have a 50-50 shot at getting the child if you only knew how. And child support. Oh, that's a big issue. I get asked that quite often. Well, child support is a requirement both of the civil law and the common law. It goes clear back to Moses at Mount Sinai. You have a duty to support your child there, daddies. Well, if you're going to support your child, why don't you take custody of your child? And then, of course, there's playmates, and then the history of child abuse. So if you're a child abuser over here, you don't have a very good chance of coming out of here with the child. Or if you have a history of child neglect, well, that'll work against you. All right. Now, when it comes to custody, that is the custody item itself, then who is it who's entitled to taking custody, or what determines custody, for instance, in Pennsylvania? Well, in making an award of custody between parents, the court must consider the best interests of the children. Overnight visitation is called partial custody. Any custody order is reviewable upon any change of circumstances. You know, you could call up a new custody hearing 12 times a year. If there's 12 changes in custody or in the circumstances of custody, in addition to that, you can call it up once per year for the entire life of the child until the child reaches 18. So this custody is reviewable every year, daddies. And a child's desires with regard to custody and parental custody are given more weight as the child gets older. Until age 12, such desires have very little weight. Third parties can obtain custody very rarely. Grandparents have a right to visitation that is statutorily guaranteed in some situations, and particularly where their child, the parent of their grandchildren, has died or is separated from the grandchildren's other parent. Did you know that you grandparents also have rights in many states, or in most states, as a matter of fact? And there are such things as contempt of a custody order. You know, if your spouse is in contempt of a custody order, you can have the custody order modified and have parental custody terminated. Termination of parental rights. And then grandparents and custodial rights come into play. And the custody generally. You know, custody embraces the sum of parental rights with respect to the rearing of a child, including his care. And it includes the right to the child's services and earnings, and the right to direct his activities and to make decisions regarding his care and control, education, health, and religion. The legal custody of a minor is in the parent's or the surviving parent, unless there's been a court adjudication awarding custody to a third person. Now let's take a look at the guardian ward relationship. You know, there's a guardian ward relationship that comes into play with the state, the mommy, and the daddy. And this guardian ward relationship is called a trust relationship. Listen to this. Did you know that a guardianship is a trust relation of the most sacred character? Sacred, sacred. Hey, that's kind of religious, isn't it? In which one person who is called a guardian acts for another called the ward, whom the law regards as incapable of managing his own affairs. Now, you know, when custody is taken away from you, whether you're a mother or a father, do you know that the state then is acting in a guardian ward relationship between you and the state and is taking the guardianship away from the you and the child, or the control of the child away from you in a guardian ward relationship? They view you as being a ward of the state. Have you ever thought of yourself as being a ward, incapable of managing your own affairs, incapable of raising or rearing your own child? Well, that's what it boils down to. Now, a curator is a guardian appointed by the court to control property of a minor. He's not a guardian of the person, and in some jurisdictions, a conservator may be appointed. He has the same powers and obligations as a guardian so far as they relate to the property of the ward, so that in effect, he is a guardian of the estate. Now, the purpose of statutes relating to guardianship is to safeguard the rights and interests of minors and incompetent persons, and the court should be vigilant to see that the rights of such persons are properly protected. The court having jurisdiction of a guardianship matter is said to be the superior guardian, while the guardian himself is deemed to be an officer of the court. So what you do is you go out and get a marriage license and create a three-party limited general partnership. Then you have children. As a member of the three-party limited general partnership, the state is the superior partner and gives custody to mommy and daddy, or in the event of a divorce of mommy and daddy, gives custody to one of the surviving parents as it deems best in the child's best interest. That's a guardian ward relationship in which, when you get a marriage license and have a child, you become the state's babysitter over the state's child, and you can raise the state's child in the state's school, educate the state, the child in the state's humanist religion. And if you decide that you don't want to do any of the above, then you're subject to having new babysitters appointed. That's called termination of parental rights. About 2.5 million children a year are taken out of their homes and placed in foster care because the state is dissatisfied with mommy and daddy and wants to change babysitter. So if you're a mother or father and you have children with a marriage license and a birth certificate, you, as a matter of law, are an officer of the court, a guardian over the child. And your guardianship over the child is subject to replacement by a new babysitter if the state decides that they're not satisfied with your guardianship. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, the appointment of a conservator works like this. In several states, statutes authorize a person who, although of sound mind, when he believes that he's incapable of managing his own estate or of caring for his own property, he may apply for, request, or simply consent to the appointment of a conservator or a guardian of his estate or of his person or both, and that's the marriage license, and who, when appointed, possesses over the estate substantially the same powers and is subject in regard thereto to substantially the same duties as a guardian of an incompetent. So when you get a marriage license, you declare yourself to be incompetent, unable to manage a family. I mean, after all, you may become unemployed one of these days and you won't be able to feed, clothe, and house your family. And so, therefore, you're going to need the benefits of the state, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, or something of the like. You want to avail yourself of the safety net, do you not? All Americans do. Most Americans have. Now, what would happen if you decided that you would like to determine whether or not your child has immunization? How would it be if you decided on your child's school? Well, Did you know that every state in the union makes provisions for an exemption to immunization, save for two, Mississippi and West Virginia, and homeschool by all 50 states, and that you can educate your child at home or in a parochial school or in public school, and that you can choose if you just knew how to use the family law of your state to accomplish that goal. Same thing is true with immunization. You see, immunization violates the scripture. And any time that there is a law that violates the scripture, then God comes in and creates a waiver for those people who want to obey God and keep his commandments. So, except for Mississippi and West Virginia, which you'll have to get a court order. So in school, I'll teach you how to get a court order. Or if you're in Missouri, there's a waiver. And if you're in California, you can object on just personal moral grounds. Just personal moral grounds. And there's an objection. And if you'll put in your objection, take the waiver, you can avoid or prohibit or prevent immunization or public school. Now remember, this comes under Wickard versus Filburn. The government regulates and controls that which it subsidizes. What would happen if you wanted to get married and you didn't want any government subsidies? Hey, did you know that you could have a baby, you could have a marriage, and you can function in American society as a common law free man without government intervention? That's a wild new concept that we make available and explain in detail here in the Family Law School. Family Law. For more information, just call the school. That's 317-273-4967. That's area code 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to my webpage. It's georgegordon.com. That's georgegordon.com. Click on to the email and send me an email request, and we'll give you more information about Family Law. All right, let's take a break here, and we'll come back and take up the next subject, which will be the Civil Rights Act, Title 46.